You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Get to people, yeah.
What are you gonna
you gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all? Yeah.
I've never meant cares about you.
Ain't giving up a second thought about you. No. Ghetto people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell me.
People.
You gotta take a look at yourself.
Yeah.
Ghetto people. With your life
running like a red disease,
running like a red disease. Ghetto people,
stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, yo. You got to learn to love yourself. Yeah, ghetto people.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything that on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Maafa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Maafa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement: Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted. And we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashe. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotep family, hope everything is well for you today. It's the weekend. It's Friday. So I hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But if it's not, and it has to get done, and you know it has to get done, and you know that you're the one to do it, I know you will. Because that's the kind of brother and sister that you is. But if it doesn't need to get done, and you should be staying safe, particularly here in the South and in the Southwest and in the West, because coronavirus is ravishing this country. And the most important thing to do is to be safe. Wear masks. Wash your hands. Make sure you're practicing social distance. It's imperative. It's imperative. You are listening to African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. If you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. At the top of the page, look at podcast, click on that, and then the drop down, you'll see African Perspectives. Click on that, and then there will be programs that are dated and titled. Other program we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. Once again, this program is every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. All times they're going to give are Eastern times. On Mondays, Monday evening from 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds Public Affairs Programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Wahad, followed by Conversation Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10. And then on Thursdays, Black Reality Think Tank Millennials on Thursday. And then on Friday, if it's Friday, and today is Friday, oh, well, this evening at 8 p.m., it'll be Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. On Saturday, Black Reality Think Tank Weekend Edition, followed by the Sankofa Elders Council with Brother Alfonso Watkins. On Sunday, 7 p.m., Time for an Awakening, once again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Sunday at 7 p.m. Monday through Friday from 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., the Warren Ballantyne Show right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And the number to call is 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. We Buy Black, the largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses is WeBuyBlack.com. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses from WeBuyBlack.com. Africa for the Africans, Brother Bomani Tayemba, who has done an outstanding job of taking our brothers and sisters back home, exposing them to the beauty of Africa and African people. Go to his website, AfricaForTheAfricans.org. Give him a call at 404 931-9429. He has two trips upcoming this year. I'm not sure if they are canceled as of this time. And I know that if they will be, we'll see it up on the website. But he has a trip to South Africa, November 20th through the 30th, $3,700 this year, November 20th through the 30th. And then Ghana, December 24th to January 5th, 2021, also $3,700. Everything you need to access those trips are on the website. So go to AfricaForTheAfricans.org. But if you want to see pictures of previous tours, go to Facebook.com/Bomani. If you want to see videos of previous tours, go to YouTube.com/Bomani2007. Rinoco has two trips next year. His two trips next year, they are to Uganda and Rwanda. January 21st through February 4th. January 21st through February 4th, Uganda and Rwanda. I'm not sure if it's still around $4,200. The other trip is August 1st through August 14th, 2021, and that's going to Kemet. Go to drrinoco.com, drrinoco.com. If you want to give him a call, 323-803-8663, 323-803-8663, Rinoco Rashidi. Habashah Incorporated.org. Go to Habashahincorporated.org. They are doing the work. These brothers and sisters are doing outstanding work on the continent and in our community here in Atlanta and elsewhere. They definitely deserve to be supported. Okay. The Shrine of the Black Madonna, unfortunately, is still closed, and it probably will be. Man, this is crazy. The Medu Bookstore, I'm not sure that I need to call Mama Nia to find out what's happening with her. You know, because this stuff is crazy. They're about to close down things again. So, but the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall, is the number to call is 404-346-3263. She has books, postcards, greeting cards, certificates, T-shirts, all kinds of good stuff. Give Mama Nia a call at 404-346-3263. The other bookstore we promote here is the Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore in Lithonia. Straight east, going straight east from Atlanta off of I-20 is the Black Duck Cultural Center and Bookstore. My good friend, Brother Gazimde Ajamu, the proprietor, they now have a coffee bar. So check them out. Give them a call at 404-519-8107. 404-519-8107. Wadada's Healthy Market and Juice Bar located in the West End here in Atlanta on Ralph David Abernathy. Delicious smoothies and juice drinks and all kinds of good stuff, health food stuff. They also carry We Buy Black. We Buy Black products you can get from Wadada's Healthy Market and Juice Bar. Also, you can get the Afroletics, which is the sportswear with African themes. Beautiful design sportswear, the Zulus, the Dogon Star Seed, the Omex, the Head Roos, you know. All kinds of good stuff. So check it out at Wadada's Healthy Market and Juice Bar located in the West End. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People, their Thursday night broadcast last night at 9 p.m. Us Lifting Us on Blog Talk Radio. Go to blogtalkradio.com/ULU. The name of the program is Dare to Win every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Or you can call. You can call just to listen, or you can call to ask questions, comments, or concerns. And that number is 929-477-2789. That's right, 929-477-2789. Sanjay-Haiti, Sister Gabrielle Aurelia in the northeastern portion of Haiti, Sister Gabby, outstanding work. Go to Sanjay, Sonjay-Haiti, AYITI.org, Sanjay-Haiti.org. Akaban Institute, brothers and sisters, Baba Baruti and Sister Yah, have been doing an outstanding job of raising our young warriors. They deserve the support please make a check, money, or out to Akabin Institute. Send it to P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. But, of course, you can easily do it through PayPal and Cash App. The dollar sign, YYAA, the letter M, then Baruti, B-A-R-U-T-I. The Complementarity Conference, the 6th Annual Complementarity Conference, is here tomorrow, July 18th, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern. This is a virtual conference. The donation is $10, $5 for young folks. Go to PayPal or Cash App and put that information in. It is an online program. Okay? And hope to see you there. The conference is tomorrow. The Enye Sesim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. The Enye Sesim. July 16th. Nothing pains some people more than having to think. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We can never overemphasize the importance of tradition. Our traditions are all that have come to work for us. They reflect our human essence, our interpretation of the universe, and are the most apparent manifestations of our aesthetic and cultural imperatives. Being traditional does not mean being archaic, outdated, outmoded, primitive, backwards, useless, or out of sync with reality. For tradition is more or less than all of the intellectual, mechanical, metaphysical technology which naturally maintains a people as they come to see themselves in this universe. It is a result of untold generations consciously working together to correct their errors and to perfect those corrections. Tradition is the culmination of all that has been tried and proven true through the experience of a people. It defines that people's worth and existence. For these reasons and more, we must get over the idea that our traditions in and of themselves, but especially relative to the Europeans, the Arabs, and the Asians, are bad, dysfunctional, useless, or liabilities. We must stop allowing others to convince us that most traditions do not make sense, and they do not have to make sense, and therefore can be discarded at will because they serve people way back then. When conditions acknowledge expectations are said to have been based on unfounded superstitions, bogus mythology, and absence of rational scientific thinking, we should know better than to continue to believe the truth of liars. Affirm, I am traditional in every African way. Affirm, I am traditional in every African way. July 17th. The willingness to change strategy is a fundamental requirement of an intelligent community engaged in a protracted struggle against an enemy. Professor Manu Apem. Revolution has never been an option for Negroes. A non-confrontational compliance toward their oppressors is their innately fundamental political philosophy. They can only act against their own. Sure, they would love to talk with you about black problem under the pretense of group solidarity, but it is only to distract you from your purpose, which with protracted, meaningless, barren debate, thereby earning themselves invaluable brownie points from their own and sworn masters. To blindly embrace a self-defeating philosophy because it is human or bring us together is ludicrous if we wish to independently empower an African nation. You do not embrace those who will take you straight to hell. No matter how much blood you share with them. Some will never listen. Everyone is not able to see, and there are casualties in every war. The conversion of Negroes is not a goal or option for African warrior scholars. Some Africans have a vested interest in being African. The idea that finding difference among African further divides and weakens us does not take into account the fact that there are people within our group who must be routed out and rooted out
in order for us to make African progress. You cut the bad infectious animal from the herd. You don't keep it there just for numbers. Progress cannot occur through embracing enemies within. Affirm, I do not embrace those who would take me straight to their hell. Affirm, I do not embrace those who would take me straight to their hell. July 18th. Life is hard. Ron Johnson. Why are the fastest growing suicide rates among African males? In short, suicide is a function of feeling of hopelessness that led to depression, a debilitating psychological disease, mostly in societies where self-esteem is extremely derived, leaving victims with an overwhelming pessimistic belief that they are doomed to failure. Powerless outsiders caught up in the insanity of European definitions are even more affected by its self-destructive solutions to powerlessness than its carriers. One thing many of our adults fail to understand is that our children have an enhanced sensitivity to this cultural insanity and the real racial realities it perpetuates against its victims. They understand that the worst possible quality that a person can have in this Europeanized world is to be African. Knowing the logical connection between feelings of powerlessness and committing suicide, we should easily be able to understand better why young American African or African males are increasingly committing suicide in this country, because they have the potential, to be African men. European Caucasian extremism, racism, and privilege, better known as white supremacy, sees them as their greatest potential threat. It is for this reason they are the targeted with the greatest assault. For warrior scholars knowing this, then, the question is not whether there is going to be difficulty in life, because there always is. Life is hard. The question is, how will you handle it? Will you stand as an African, or will you fall victim to the definitions of self others have created to destroy you? Affirm, I handle difficulty standing. Affirm, I handle difficulty standing and standing strong. I shave the Enye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought. I'm waiting on my guest, Brother Akil Parker. We're going to talk about some serious sisters in our lives, in our history, sisters that many of you know. Obviously, we're going to try to bring some depth to these sisters. They're truly, they're truly some beautiful women who deserve our attention. These sisters, all I can say is, when you talk about Asada Shakur and Ida Bell Wells Barnett, you're talking about two determined, strong sisters that we should celebrate. Because yesterday was their birthday. They say they share the same birthday. So we're going to talk about those two. And so when I get Brother Kill, when he gives us a call. Yeah. Sometimes, you kind of forget. So let me try to see if I can, Let me play a little something right there. So as we kind of. Yes. Okay. Okay. But like I said, I tell you, I have such deep admiration for our people, men, women, children, elders,
ancestors. I have a deep admiration, a love, and a respect. I mean, I feel like, who was that? Oh, I know it was. Martin Robinson Delaney. You know, I said, I thank God for making me, no, I thank God for making me a black man. I thank God for making me a black man, an African man. And because I tell you, you know, when I look at the world and so forth, and I look at how it's been structured as of late, and the evil that is in the world, and I know who's the perpetrator of that evil, I am glad that we are African. I know this is a deep struggle to overturn all this ignorance and all the things that have happened to us and continue to happen to us. But it will get done. It will be done. As long as there's one African who is determined to be African, has breath, it will get done. It will be done. So my guest is here, Brother Akil Parker. Good morning to you. How you doing?
Morning. Peace. Hotep.
Hotep. Doing well, brother. Good. Good. So you've been doing okay, man. You staying cool in Philly?
Yeah, you know, holding it down, trying to, you know, do my thing, you know, the best I can. Yeah. You know, getting used to new online normalcy.
Yeah, and that's what it is. You know, when you have a meeting, I mean, last Saturday, there was like about 6 Zoom meetings going right on, man, back and forth. You know, I tried my best to get them all, but you can't get them all, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So today, we're going to talk about Sister Asada Shakur and Ida B. Wells. Who you want to start with first? Who you want to start with first?
I figure we start chronologically, since Ida B. Wells was born in 1862.
Let's do that.
And, you know, Asada Shakur was born 85 years later in 1947. We start with Ida B. Wells. Hopefully we have enough time, because it's really, I mean, kind of doesn't really do justice to both of them. But, I mean, we could, you know, talk for 10 hours and not have enough time to really talk about them, you know, either.
No. And you're right. To do them the real justice in terms of trying to explain who they were and what they've done and the impact they've made, both of these sisters. Like I said, as I said before you came on, the you know, how I honor sisters, how I honor our women, particularly our warrior women. You know, when you look at some serious warrior sisters in our history, on the continent, in the Caribbean, and here on this soil, you know, especially Ida B. Wells, because she could have, I mean, she was shot, you know, but she wasn't lynched, thank God, you know. Because she's the one that brought it to the attention of this country, the constant lynching. She chronicled it. She did stories on it, you know.
Right.
And then when the threat of her being killed in Memphis, because they were going to kill her, there's no doubt about that, you
right.
know. So that she had to. I'm sorry, you broke up on you.
That's about a character.
Brother Kill?
Yeah, can you hear me?
You're breaking up on me really bad.
Can you hear me now?
That sounds better.
Yeah. Now, I was saying that's when she started, when the death threats came, that's when she started carrying her pistol.
Yeah. You got to protect yourself. Yeah, you got to protect yourself, man. You know? Yeah.
And these conversations are very important, of the utmost importance, because it speaks to something that Dr. Baruti has written about, the African complementarity.
Mm.
You know, so this is
right, and that's real, right, and that's what they're having tomorrow, the complementarity conference. Baba and Ya Baruti are having a complementarity conference tomorrow, and I'll plug that again. But you're right; that's the thing that we as African people must understand, that our men and our women, we work together, we struggle together, we fight together.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, so we start with, and I mainly want to talk about So a little bit of biography on her, biographical information on her, but then like this major incident that really affected her trajectory in terms of dealing with the lynching, because it became anti-lynching crusade, because it became personal. Mm-hmm. 1892, the three brothers that owned the People's Grocery Company.
Yeah. They're right in Memphis. They vamped on them. Mm-hmm. And they killed them. You know?
Let me start with some biography. So okay. You know, sister Ida B. Wells, later Barnett. She married a man in she met in Chicago, last name Barnett. Mm-hmm. And born in Holly Springs, Mississippi on July 16th. And that's another reason why I offered this topic today, because they share a birthday. Asada Shakur, right, and Ida B. Wells, they share a birthday, July 16th. Mm-hmm. And I think you know, that's another thing in terms of like meeting, in terms of us meeting our people where they are and offering information about people. One of the things that we can do is I came up with this idea, this like kind of gimmick, right? Called Let Them Eat Cake.
Okay. Right?
Me and my family, we didn't participate in this yesterday because, you know, we had other things going on. But what it does is, like, you know, we identify different members of our history and revolutionaries and, you know, workers and freedom fighters, and on their birthdays, and we basically just, you know, we pay homage to them and, you know, kind of like celebrate their birthday, you know. Mm-hmm. go out, and it's something easy you could do, you know, go to the grocery store, buy a little, you know, birthday cake or maybe some cupcakes or whatever. I mean, there's so many of our people. I started thinking about it more strategically and logistically, and I said, well, man, like, you know, so many of our people, we really get into this, like, we'd be eating, you know, birthday cake every day.
So,
I got to figure out a way to modify this, yeah, to, you know, still to make the impression and have the young people understand and connect their historical awareness, you know, with their taste buds. Yeah. You know, that's what you remember. Like, you remember that, you know, that good meal you had at, you know, your grandmother's house or whatever.
That's,
you know,
right,
you always remember conversations that happened because of that eating experience, right?
Right.
So this would be like a, you know, example of a time when, you know, we could, you know, have, you know, let them eat cake and, you know, just have conversations about, you know, Asada Shakur and about Ida B. Wells on July 16th, you know, every year, you know, and just the young people will know, so that the young people will have examples like these sisters that they could follow, because otherwise then, you know, the establishment is going to give them commercial rappers, you know, sisters that are colonial and neo-colonial. Just like they give the brothers the examples that are colonial and neo-colonial, mm-hmm, as the example that they should want to follow. So
right,
that's another reason why this conversation is important. And hopefully anyone that's listening, you know, the adults can, you know, that don't already know this information can, you know, be inspired to study more. You know, can be inspired to study more, learn more, so they can then impart that information onto their children, their grandchildren, their, you know, youngins and little cousins and nieces and nephews and everything.
Right.
Yeah. So with that, yeah, like I said, she was born July 16th, 1862. She transitioned in 1931 on March 25th. Another reason why this is important, because on the south side of Chicago, there was a housing project named after her.
Right. That's right. I've been over that way. In fact, down the street from there, well, the White Sox Park, that's on that same street. And there's a American African Motor Lodge or motel on that same street. And of course, up the street from there is, as you further go east from the Dan Ryan Expressway. Okay. It's like 35th Street. So you can you'll pass right by the Ida B. Wells housing projects. As you go further east, you'll push. Jesse Jackson's organization is that way. But even before you get to Push is the Northern Illinois University for Inner City Studies, which is now the Dr. Jacob Carruthers Center for Inner City Studies. Yeah. Right up the street from there. So I'm very familiar with that neighborhood. And in fact, I know a sister that lives in Milwaukee who was born in Chicago, lived in Ida B. Wells. Yeah.
I think they were torn down in
the
final bills down in 2002. But I bring that up because it made me think about here in Philly, in North Philly, there's the Richard Allen houses, right?
Okay, also torn, sure.
But the kind of the idea, so that, again, it's all about the marketing. Like, when we associate, a lot of us will associate, I'm sure in Chicago and beyond, we'll associate the projects with Ida B. Wells, the projects and all their kind of challenges with Ida B. Wells, or here in Philly, all the, you know, the projects and all their challenges with Richard Allen. So mm-hmm. these are people that we need to, like, you know, really let people know, like, no, these were thorough and very significant people
right.
that, you know, we, and so don't get caught up in the, oh, well, you know, the projects were named after them. So, mm-hmm. you know, they couldn't, you know, that important or that right. noteworthy.
That's a very good point. That's a very yeah. good point, man, because a lot of times, and, you know, I'm quite sure that when the projects were first made, it's, you know, just like Cabrini Green or Robert Taylor Holmes in Chicago and a number of other places in Chicago, and, man, but over time, the deterioration of those places, truly not fitting the names of those buildings of the people they were named after, no doubt, because Ida B. Wells. And there is a house that she lived in Chicago that became, from my understanding, I'm not sure exactly where, on the south side of Chicago. There's a house that she lived in that became as a national landmark
okay.
in Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. It's yeah. a Chicago landmark, a national landmark. Yeah. Because, I mean, she is that prominent of an individual. She is that strong of a person, you know. And what she has done is just tremendous, you know, bringing this country's attention to the lynching issue and the segregation. In fact, I didn't know until I did a little reading that she was one of the founding members of the NAACP.
Right.
You know.
That's something I want to read more up on, because I know that there was some conflict and some drama, I guess, between, like, with her and that I've heard of with her and W.E.B. Du Bois, and I want to do some independent research so I can know, like, what that, you know, beyond, like, the yeah. hearsay and what heard,
right okay
what actually happened,
because you know probably what it was, you know, I mean, just dealing with the reality of even still to this day, how women are regarded in the society. And of course, we were affected as well. Not everybody are strong African men, American African men, who understand the importance of an American African woman or an African woman by your side or within the organization. I knew that from a long time ago when I was president of our local chapter of Black Firefighters in Milwaukee, and we were having a convention. I could not, and I was the chair, I could not have done what we did at that convention without those sisters.
Right.
Because the firefighters, they're good brothers, you know, but nobody works harder and pays more attention to detail and things than sisters, you know? And so I thank them tremendously.
And that's their complementarity.
That's right.
Again. That's definitely needed. Early on, like, if I could jump back into this.
Sure.
So early on, the early education at Shaw University, but not the Shaw University that we may know of in North Carolina, Shaw University, which was formerly called Rust College, or maybe it's called Rust College today.
Yeah, it's called Rust College today. Right. Now it's called Rust College.
She became a primary school teacher. She became a primary school teacher, first in Mississippi and Holly Springs. But then, you know, her parents passed away. And there's some historical context that we can relate to here
yeah,
because
right.
yellow fever epidemic, That's yellow right. fever epidemic in the late 1870s that mm-hmm. hit Mississippi and Southwest Tennessee. So that's like the context for, like, you know, similar to like COVID-19, how, you know, some people have unfortunately transitioned from that. But, you know, this was an epidemic, mm-hmm. you know, so she moved to Tennessee. With the widow of one of her uncles that had passed away, with her younger siblings. So that's another thing about
right.
her that was phenomenal to me, was that she was, you know, a young sister, and she was like, you know, I got to step up, and I got to, you know, my parents aren't here, so I'm the oldest child. So I got to take responsibility for, I can't be a teenager. I can't be, you know, a young woman out here doing my thing or doing things where I might typically do. I got to become the mother.
Right.
I got to become a matron. You
That's
know,
right. She got to support calls. These kids. She got to care for her brothers and sisters, her siblings. That's right. Yeah.
Right. So that's another thing. So then she goes, you know, she ends up in Woodstock, a town called Woodstock, Tennessee, in around 1884. Right. So she's like, but at that time, later on in Woodstock, Tennessee, this is after that, right? She was mm-hmm. a racial segregation lawsuit because she was removed from a whites only ladies' coach on the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad. Now, she initially won the case, and I think this is the story where she, you know, she got into the fight with the white man who was the conductor, who was telling her she had to get off, and he was trying to pull her off, and she even like bit his hand, you know, mm-hmm. when she was like, you know, put his hands on her, and she was like forcibly removed from the car. She filed a lawsuit. She originally won, but then Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, they appealed the decision, and then, you know, it was overturned in the Tennessee State Supreme Court. So she ultimately ended up losing. But, you know, there's a lot of precedent. Again, like the history and the genealogy is important, because, you know, while the Montgomery, you know, bus boycott, you know, was important. But just we should always understand that these were things that were going on in different parts of the country. And these mm-hmm. were, you know, it wasn't just, because a lot of times in Western historiography, they try to do this, you know, tell, you know, Marvel Comics, like superhero
yeah.
narrative.
Yeah.
Oh, there was person that did this, like, you know what I mean? It's like, nah, it was a lot of us doing this,
right?
You know,
but that's why I always say we were not slaves. We should not mm-hmm. call our ancestors slaves, because a slave is something or somebody that submits its will to a master. We never submitted. We always right. resisted. We always fought back. No, I understand sometimes there was some complacency or some acquiescence, you know, because of the conditions. Because hell, another thing is you want to survive, you want to live. But there's also a right. time when you stand up. And that's what she did. That's what a lot of our other people did at various times. We stood up and we resisted and we fought back. Yeah.
Right. And speaking of that, I mean, that ties right into, you know, what she ends up getting involved in, which is propaganda. So she understands the power of propaganda. First starting out as a school teacher, but then says, you know, I need to provide propaganda, which is, you know, even in my own experience, you know, I kind of, you know, was a full-time traditional high school teacher, but then I decided I wanted to do more writing. You know, mm-hmm. to provide, you know, share ideas and, you know, theories and, you know, provide positive propaganda for our people. So she gets involved with a local newspaper called Free Speech and Headlight. She later takes over the newspaper, Free Speech, in order so that we could tell our own stories.
Right.
You know, and like you said, like the people that have been largely responsible for propagandizing and telling us our stories about our experience are people that don't want us to win. They have been our enemies. So therefore, of course, they're going to paint this picture that, you know, we would like the docile slave, you know, kneeling down, mm-hmm. you know, people like Lincoln to free us. And
yep.
they're going to paint the pictures and show those and share those narratives for years and years and years, generation upon generation upon generation, where it's like, like, that's not the story. That's not, you know, that kind of like, it's like, no, that's not our ancestors. I'll tell you what our ancestors did. And we mm-hmm. have documented everything
right.
what our ancestors did. So it really is a question of like, who's telling the story, you know, like,
of course, the Europeans always going to, on his side of the story, make himself the philanthropic caring, even though he is the creator of the evil. It's just like right. that statue they took down of Teddy Roosevelt recently. And put it in some place where he's on a horse, and on one side, to the right side, I believe is an indigenous person, a Native American, and to the left side is an African. You know, basically, of course, what is it saying? You know, I'm riding a horse and I come and I free you. You know, just like that other one, there's a statue of an African, and they're taking the cover off of him, showing him the guiding light. I don't know. But, you know, they're always going to have, Europeans are always going to put themselves into the best light. I understand that. They're not mm-hmm. going to tell of the atrocities and all the evilness that they have done, you know.
And I don't even, I'm at the point where I don't even think that we should spend as much energy as we have spent in many cases trying to get them to tell the truth. If right. they want to tell lies, you know, to their children, mm-hmm. then, you know, that's on them. But I think that what it should inspire us to do is, you know, become more organized, become more aware, do this research, do this study, create educational spaces where we can tell our children the truth.
Right.
Because it's like, kind of like, you know, within a neighborhood, you know, you might have different households have different belief systems and operate upon different principles and values. And sometimes you got to say, like, you know, you might want the best for them, but you're like, yo, you tell your children, like, yo, those people over there, man, nah, they you know, they're kind of silly, you know, mm-hmm. with how they move. And we might just need to just love them from afar, just let them right. be silly. But this household, true, you know, the proper way to do things. right? So I think that, you know, that ties into us, like, again, doing the work of creating the independent educational spaces, which can grow into independent educational institutions that should be African-centered, and that we must have, and it must be mandatory and not just kind of like extracurricular, right, or kind of like, it would be nice if we had it. It's like, we're at the point where this is imperative. Like, this is really imperative. Like, we have to have this so that we can tell the proper stories, you know, to our children. Like I said, like, you know, I wanted to discuss with her, because the thing, one of the major impacts and experiences she had was in the year 1892, some mob violence and lynching in Memphis, Tennessee. There were three of her friends named Thomas Moss. And this really ties into, you know, today, some things we need to think about. We're talking about Black business, supporting Black businesses, which we should do. We're talking about Black economic empowerment, Black economic development. So, and again, there's nothing new about this. Like, you know, a lot of people, we talk about what I call, Little Africa. Is it Little Africa or Little Haiti? Because I hate saying, you know, I sat in on a session with a brother down in Atlanta and his wife, Wakeza and Ife Mazimoyo.
He was up here last year.
He put me on to the true name, like what the local people called the Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma. So, because I try to think more deeply about the term Black Wall Street, because, you know, Wall Street is kind of like, you know, it kind of makes me cringe because of what I know. I know everybody doesn't know that, but it makes me cringe a little bit because
Black Wall Street was created by taking that land from us and killing us.
And even the name itself, it's like we're trying to superimpose something Black upon something that's white. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like people say things like, you know, well, you know, Morehouse or Howard, those are the Black Ivy League.
Right.
Like, we don't need the Black version of anything white. We don't need to do that, because when we do that, what we're consciously or even unconsciously doing is we're bowing down and we're admitting inferiority by saying that we're the Black version of something white. We can be the Black version of Black.
That's right. I mean, I love that.
Greeks came to Kemet to study from us. Mm-hmm. Like, so we should not be like, this is backwards, right? This is really backwards. But anyway, either Little Africa or Little Haiti. I know there was a thriving area in North Carolina. I think maybe that was called Little Haiti. And I think Green was referred to as Little Africa. So these brothers in Memphis, Thomas Moss, and I think it's important to, you know, say their names. You know, like, I think, you know, I remember listening to a lecture by Dr. Bobby Wright, and he was talking about how, you know, most of us, we don't know the names of the four little girls that were killed in the in the terrorist,
right, in Birmingham,
1963. And we need to know that, you know, like, I'm ashamed to say I can't recall like all four of their names, like Denise McNair, you know, Addie Mae Collins. Two of them, but the other two like escape me all the time. But these three brothers started this grocery store called the People's Grocery Company. Thomas Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Henry Stewart. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about this is that, you know, like Thomas Moss was a postal worker. He was a mailman. He would you know, him and Ida B. Wells became friendly. She was friends with him and his wife. He was a mailman, so the mailman has the information. So a lot of information and things that were going on in the community, he would tell her about, and these were things that she could end up, you know, writing about, you know, in the newspaper, free speech,
right?
They are a personal relationship, and that's how things were. But the interesting thing about this story is, like, it's very relatable, because basically the way it starts is right there in Memphis, some Black boys and some white boys were playing a game of marbles, right?
Right.
So the white boys lost, got mad, and they started a fight with the Black boys. The Black boys just beat their ass, basically. Right?
Yeah.
One of the white boys that got beat up, he goes back and tells his dad.
Right.
His dad and beats up one of the Black boys. So then the Black boy go tells his dad. So then his dad and his boys, his homies come in and beat up the white man, as they should do, you know, protecting their child. What the hell is wrong with you putting your hands on my child?
Right.
Like, you know, and this is what we do. So then there's some like retaliation. Let me see what else, because I'm kind of reading from her autobiography. This is Ida B. Wells' autobiography entitled Crusade for Justice, which is edited by her granddaughter, Alfreda Duff. that's how the situation like really started, right? A fight between some children. Mm-hmm. A white man decided it was appropriate to put his hands on a black boy, and the black boy's father comes and says, "Nah, we're not doing that around here.
Right?
That's not. Yeah, nah, we're not doing that." So then, you know, the black men, as I said, the black men won the fight. The white father and the grocery keeper, then they try to file charges because they got beat up. They came and, you know, beat up his son and then got beat up in return. So then they try to file charges with the police. You know, the grocery keeper, the case was dismissed, you know, with just some fines, right?
Right.
So the grocery, they got some fines, right? So then the challenge was issued that the vanquished whites were coming on Saturday night to clean out the People's Grocery Company. So then they're like, you know, they're like, okay, we're going to mess up your grocery store. You know, right. And there was already animosity.
Right, because that was competition. And yeah, one thing the Crocker don't like, one thing he really don't like is competition because he really can't compete. Okay, there it is.
It's competition, you know. So it goes to show you that, like, even the conservative, I always thought about this, like, even the conservative whites, they claim that, you know, they talk all that, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Mm-hmm. We don't want to give anything and all that. But even when we do that, when we are self-reliant, it's still a problem because it takes money out of their pocket. And I thought about that when you think about if we shift over later on to like Malcolm X and how, like, who murdered Malcolm X's father. Malcolm X's father was a Garveyite. His mother was a Garveyite.
Mm-hmm.
So they're preaching. They're in Nebraska. Preaching self-reliance, preaching do for self, preaching, you know, we don't need to, you know, get these white people don't like us, fine. We don't need them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets murdered for preaching that. So then it's like, oh, okay, so you don't like us, you don't want us around, but yet you want us, you know, so it kind of exposes that.
Right.
I wrote an article about the fact that, you know, these people do know that our lives matter, right? So kind of like challenging some of the ideology of Black Lives Matter people. They know our lives matter, but our lives matter for two main things. To them, as a source of cheap labor and for hyper-consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
They need us to spend money with them, and they need us to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they have a computer to replace us. Then, you know,
Which is happening now. That's why.
It's happening right
now. Yeah.
You know? But they're still going to need us to spend money at their stores,
mm-hmm.
right? Or patronize their establishments. And even when you think about, like, government entities, like public schools, it's going to be a problem when we really start developing our own independent educational institutions because we won't be going to their schools. So again, that's another form of consumerism. You know,
right.
We can say education consumerism that we wouldn't be participating in. But then it says in the text, knowing that the owners of the company consulted a lawyer and were told that they were outside the city limits and beyond police protection, right? So they would be justified in protecting themselves if attacked. So I guess it's like, okay, well, you know, the police don't protect us out here. So if we shoot these white men when they come to try to kill us, then, you know, it's legal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we couldn't call and have we couldn't call the police and have y'all come out here and stop them from shooting us. So we had to do for self. Then it says, accordingly, the grocery company armed several men. And then again, these stories excite me. And these are stories that we need to know about because, again, it pushes back on this whole, like, oh, we were docile. And,
right.
You know, white people just at any given moment and on their whim, they just, you know, killed us, beat us up, lynched us and whatnot. Because even this, like, there was a lynching. These brothers were lynched, but it didn't go down like that. It wasn't easy. It wasn't sweet. It says, accordingly, the grocery company armed several men and stationed them in the rear of the store on that fatal Saturday night, not to attack, but to repel a threatened attack. So they knew it was war. These white people are going to try to come in and shoot us. We ready for them. Like, they, you know, they could do that if they want to. And Saturday night was the time when men of both races congregated in their respective groceries. So the grocery store was like a hangout spot,
mm-hmm.
right? For adult. And I don't know, maybe it's like, you know, kind of like a juke joint speakeasy type situation. I don't know. Those details aren't in here. I'm just, you know, speculating. But it then goes further to say about 10 o'clock that night when Thomas was posting his books for the week, doing his accounting work, and Calvin McDowell and his clerk were waiting on customers preparatory to closing, shots rang out in the back room of the store. The men stationed there had seen several white men stealing through the rear door and fired on them without a moment's pause. So they were ready.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, yeah, with that, three of these men were wounded and others fled and gave the alarm. So then the newspaper comes out the next day. And again, propaganda is key, right? And us being able to tell our stories because the white newspaper comes out with a story saying that with headlines telling how officers of the law had been wounded while in the discharge of their duties, hunting up criminals who they had been told were harbored in the People's Grocery Company.
Yeah.
This is a low dive in which drinking and gambling were carried on, a resort of thieves and thugs. So this is what they're saying in their newspaper. So it riles up the white community, like, oh, these black people, look, these uppity Negroes, they're up there like opening stores and, you know, having dens of iniquity and gambling and whatnot. And, you know, these white cops that are, you know, doing that, just doing their job, trying to make the community safe. They're shooting at them, you know, like, so these are, you know, that these are the stories that story that comes out. Let me see. So ran, then Ida B. Wells goes on to say, so ran the description in the leading white journals of Memphis of this successful effort of decent black men to carry on a legitimate business. The same newspaper told of the arrest and jailing of the proprietor of the store and many of the colored people. They predicted that it would go hard with the ringleaders if these officers should die. The tale of how the peaceful homes of that suburb, and this was a suburb of Memphis called The Curve. It was a suburb called The Curve that all this is taking place in. The tale of how the peaceful homes of that suburb were raided on that quiet Sunday morning by police pretending to be looking for others who were implicated in what the papers had called a conspiracy that had been often told. Over 100 colored men were dragged from their homes and put in jail on suspicion. Right? So all day long, and the next day is a Sunday, right? All day long. Now, this, you know, so this is the white man's community, right? So all day long, the next day, and this is how the legal system operates in that space. All day long on that fateful Sunday, white men were permitted in the jail to look over the imprisoned black men. Frenzied descriptions and hearsays were detailed in the papers, which fed the fires of sensationalism. Groups of white men gathered on the street corners and meeting places to discuss the awful crime of Negroes shooting white men. So that was the crime. The crime is a Negro shooting a white man, right? That was the awful crime, right?
You know what's interesting about that? And that's why I wish our people would truly understand this history and begin to understand that nobody's going to save us but us. Right. And that and the people who we feel are friends or are having lines with us, some Caucasians, I ain't going to talk about these little few Caucasians who may be decent people. Okay, fine. But the reality is, the system that they have created, it always will support and glorify them. When those guys, when that gang of men broke into that jail to take Moss McDowell and Stewart out and killed them, nobody ever went to court or ever went to jail who did that. All the pictures that you see, and they took those pictures and they used some of those pictures they made into postcards that you could send to loved ones. Every one of those pictures that you see, not one person in those pictures was ever indicted and convicted of the heinous crime that they commit. None of them. And even, now listen, even after all of that, we had never vamped on Caucasians unless we truly had to fight back. During the time of after Reconstruction all the way into the turn of the last century, and even the time of us leaving out of the South to migrate to the North and to the West, we still just, you know, it was only during the 60s did we actually begin to physically fight back in mass.
Right.
You know, and yet all of that time, we took a lot of that stuff, just grit our damn teeth. Oh, yes, we always fought back. We will always fight back. And so to me, I didn't know the name of Moss McDowell and Stewart, but I will now. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then, you know, she also goes further to talk about another group. Cause like, you know, a lot of us, you know, we've heard of like the Black Panther Party for self-defense. And then, you know, less of us have probably heard of the Deacons for Defense that were down in Louisiana that were to protect the community. But then I just, you know, also from reading this, we learned about another group called the Tennessee Rifles. So the Tennessee Rifles were like, you know, they guarded, they were, you know, black men of the community, of that community that guarded the jail. Cause they like, you know, they know what it is. You know, this is Tennessee. This is, you know, during segregation, And this is the year 1892, right? Mm-hmm. So they're like, okay, we gotta guard the jail and protect these brothers, you know, from these white mobs when they come, similar to the way they were, you know, they were going to protect the grocery store.
Right.
You know, the white mob, basically. So, you know, what happens is, let me see. So they guarded the jail for two nights, but that Saturday night, that Sunday night, and then that Monday night. Right. But then it says here on the Tuesday following, the newspapers, which had fanned the flame of race prejudice, announced that the wounded men were out of danger and would recover. The colored men who had guarded the jail for two nights felt that the crisis was past and that they need not guard the jail the third night. While they slept, a body of picked men was admitted to the jail, which was a modern Bastille. This mob took out of their cells. They took out Thomas Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Henry Stewart, the three officials of the People's Grocery Company. They loaded them onto an engine car of a railroad, which ran behind the jail. They carried them a mile north of the city limits and horribly shot them to death. One of the morning papers held back its edition in order to supply its readers with the details of that lynching. So they was like, oh, this is drama. This is going to sell newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
These white people know and read about, or, you know, most of them, a lot of them probably illiterate anyway, but, you know, get read to about, you know, these black men being murdered in cold blood like this. From its columns was gleaned the above information, together with details, was told that it is said that Tom Moss begged for his life for the sake of his wife and child and his unborn baby. That when asked if he had anything to say, told them, tell my people to go west. There is no justice for them here.
I say, that's right.
Calvin got hold of one of the guns of the lynchers, again, fighting back, you know, not taking the line down. And because they could not loosen his grip, a shot was fired into his closed fist. When the three bodies were found, the fingers of McDowell's right hand had been shot to pieces and his eyes were gouged out.
Mm.
This that the one who wrote that news report was either an eyewitness or got the facts from someone who was.
Mm-hmm.
The shock to the colored people who knew and loved both Moss and McDowell was beyond description. Groups of them went to the grocery and elsewhere and vented their feelings in talking among themselves, but they offered no violence. Word was brought to the city hall that Negroes were massing at the curve. So check this out, where the grocery had been located. Immediately, an order was issued by the judge of the criminal court sitting on the bench, who told the sheriff to take 100 men. So this is like, and again, the history is so key, because now this all should put like George Zimmerman into better context. Because we say, well, you know, he wasn't a cop and, you know, the police told him to wait and all that. That's not the history of America. America always deputizes white men as police officers and law enforcement officials. This is here. This is proof of this. This is one of many examples. Immediately, an order was issued by the judge of the criminal court sitting on the bench, who told the sheriff to take 100 men, go out to the curb at once, and shoot down on sight any Negro who appears to be making trouble.
Damn.
So this is preventative maintenance for them. So they're like, okay, we know that we just killed three of theirs. We know that they probably would want to retaliate, so we got to be proactive. So we got to go. We got to organize a mob and kind of just, you know, keep things in order. If it even looks like it's going to be a problem, we shoot first and ask questions last. And this is the reality, right? The loafers around the courts quickly spread the news, and gangs of them rushed into the hardware stores, armed themselves, boarded the cars and rushed out to the curb. They obeyed the judge's orders literally and shot into any group of Negroes they saw with as little compunction as if they had been on a hunting trip. The only reason hundreds of Negroes were not killed on that day by the mobs was because of the forbearance of the colored men. They realized their helplessness and submitted to outrages and insults for the sake of those depending upon them. And I think that's another thing that's important too. Like when people, you know, talk all this, I'm not my ancestors stuff, like, sometimes it's like you gotta eat that, because, yeah, you know, you have a family, you have, you know, a wife, you have children. There's sometimes when, you know, you might not be able to, you know, in that moment,
like I'm,
you know,
saying, you gotta, right, like I'm saying, like sometimes we have to acquiesce, we have to, you know, chill, yeah, out, because I mean, yeah, and I do hate that, and I see people with that on it, because that gives the impression that we were docile, we were meek, we you know, we never fought back. That's a lie. That's what I'm saying. Most important thing is to remember our ancestors and what they have done. So I don't like that saying, we're not our ancestors, we'll kick your asses, as if we didn't kick ass way back then.
because it leaves out the part like, okay, the Tennessee Rifles were standing on guard outside the jail. Like, mm-hmm. okay, come, like, white people come. We got something for y'all. You're not coming in here taking these black men. And I think it was they made an error in leaving too early, thinking that, okay, it would be cool on Tuesday night. I mean, you know, but that's like a military strategical error. Mm-hmm. That happens all the time. That's just humanity. Or even the fact that when they were posted up in the back of the grocery store in the first place, when they're like, okay, we know these white men are going to come in here and try to cause trouble, so we're going to shoot at them. And that's what they did. So they're like, leave that part of the story out, you know. But I think the whole story has to be told. But then, you know, this was about warfare. This was about economics. Ida B. Wells goes on to document that this mob took possession of the People's Grocery Company, helping themselves to food and drink, and destroyed what they could not eat or steal. The creditors had the place closed, and a few days later, what remained of the stock was sold at auction. Thus, with the aid of the city and county authorities and the daily papers, that white grocer had indeed put an end to his rival Negro grocer as well as to his business. Mm-hmm. As said before, and while all this actually was happening, Ida B. Wells was in Natchez, Mississippi, hometown of Richard Wright. Right. That's where she was. She happened to be on some business in Natchez, Mississippi, when the worst of this horrible event was taking place. Thomas Moss had already been her friend, Thomas Moss had already been buried before I reached home. Although stunned by the events of that hectic week, the free speech felt that it must carry on. Its leader for the week said, quote, "The city of Memphis has demonstrated that neither character nor standing avails the Negro if he dares to protect himself against the white man or become his rival. There is nothing we can do about the lynching now, as we are outnumbered and without arms. The white mob could help itself to ammunition without pay. So they're giving them free bullets. Go kill them black people, right? Mm-hmm. Stores are giving them bullets. But the order was rigidly enforced against the selling of guns to Negroes. Mm-hmm. There is only one thing left that we can do. Save our money and leave a town which will neither protect our lives and property nor give us a fair trial in the courts, but takes us out and murders us in cold blood when accused by white persons." Mm-hmm. So that's the whole chapter. That's chapter six of her autobiography entitled Crusade for Justice, which I recommend to anybody, edited by her granddaughter, Alfreda Duster. And then the next chapter goes into talking about, you know, taking action, like leaving, like going west.
Right.
And they were, you know,
going west and going north.
And that's why, you know, the local town, that's why when she was out of town, because actually she ended up coming to Philly for a writer's conference, and she connected with T. Thomas Fortune, of the New York Age, who actually did a lot of writing for Booker T. Washington. And also I've done a little bit of research on T. Thomas Fortune. He did like writing for Booker T. Washington, and he actually went to Howard. And you know, in his autobiography, he talks about, you know, and we're talking about late 19th century. So he talks about like when he was at Howard, him and some of his classmates, you know, they're hanging out at Frederick Douglass's crib, you know, listening to Frederick Douglass tell stories, you know, about his experiences. And I'm like, wow, I remember reading that. And I'm like, you know, okay, we understand, you know, Frederick Douglass may have contradictions, but we all do.
Yeah.
But overall, I believe he's solid. But just that idea, like, okay, you're a Howard student and you hanging out with, you know, Frederick Douglass's crib, basically. And, you know, and again, so that type of example is like, you know, what, you know, I think more Howard students need to hear that, you know, and think about that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Ida B. Wells ends up out in Philadelphia at a writer's conference, meets up with T. Thomas Fortune after this. And while she's gone, they ransack the local whites, they ransack and destroy the free speech newspaper headquarters.
Right.
And really, because she's telling black people, like, we need to organize ourselves and leave and get out. Mm-hmm. So here, like, the, you know, it's an impossible position that we're placed in, because it's like, okay, we can't start businesses, because, you know, again, there's a commitment on the part of the white community to keep us in a subservient position. And if we ever, but we can't even leave. So it's like, it's an abusive relationship. You know, it's like, you're in domestic violence, you're going to beat me every day. And if I leave, you're going to try to kill me. So you just want me to stay here and get beat every day.
That's right. So listen, this is what we're going to do, brother Kill. This is what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. We want to continue with Ida B. Wells, and then we'll flow into Assata Shakur. Okay, I'm not making any announcements, anything like that. Just going to take this break. Once we come back from the break, we'll continue the conversation about the dear
my dear, amen. I've always had a thing for Ida B. Ida B. Wells, man. I really did. I think she's just a fine, beautiful woman. You know, I was like, man, she is just, and even in her old age, she kept that beauty. She kept that strength, man. She's just, she is somebody to be admired. So we're going to come back, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Brother Akil Parker, talking about Sister Ida B. Wells and Asada Shakur, whose birthday was yesterday. And so we're celebrating by acknowledging their contributions to our struggle. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. We'll be right back. You stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Dripping all over you. were here dripping all over me.
You are listening to Time For an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. My guest today is Brother Akil Parker, and we're talking about two beautiful women in our history. Well, actually, a contemporary and a sister from our history. And so we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking right now about Sister Ida Bell Wells Barnett. Sister Ida Bell.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Sir, so
go ahead, Akil.
After the lynching takes place, and after, you know, Tom Moss is one of the brothers who was one of the owners of the People's Grocery Company, you know, issues the order, not the order, but, you know, encourages the people to go west. You know, because your humanity will not be recognized here in Memphis, Tennessee, to go west. So then in the next chapter, it gets into that process, you know, when people start packing up their stuff, start leaving. And then they essentially institute a sort of economic boycott, like an impromptu economic boycott of the local businesses. It said, you know, Wells documents here. Chapter 7 that, you know, Memphis had never seen such an upheaval among colored people. Business was practically at a standstill, for the Negro was famous then, as now, for spending his money for fine clothes, furniture, jewelry, and pianos, and other musical instruments, to say nothing of good things to eat. Music houses had more musical instruments sold on the installment plan thrown back on their hands than they could find storage for. White housewives found a hitherto unknown scarcity of help and resorted to the expedient of paying their servants only half the wages due them at the end of the week. So again, historical context, you know, this is again the consumerism that we experience for different reasons. Different people do it for different reasons. I've been guilty of it, you know, time to time, I might still be guilty of it in 2020, but the consumerism that we experience is nothing new about this. Right. And the Europeans have, you know, been taking advantage of this for a very long time. And so this is why it was the issue. See, it's not an issue of, you know, killing three, you know, innocent black men just trying to defend their property and defend their store. And really it starts with them embracing their humanity and affirming their humanity and defending their children and defending their community. That's what it really starts with, right? But that wasn't the issue. So then it says that 6 weeks after the lynching, the superintendent and treasurer of the city railway company came into her office at the Free Speech and basically asked Ida B. Wells to say, can you write an article? Because I know you have influence in the black community. Can you write an article to get the people to ride the streetcars again? Right. You know, and there was no,
we losing money. We losing money, right. So sell out.
Losing money. We need you to go and, you know, go tell them to, and yeah. These types of things happen today. And, you know, we have some Negroes that, you know, bow down and, you know, give them a check and they say, hey, you know, go, I need you to, this corporation comes along and say, hey, I'll give you this check. I need you to go tell the black people to do this, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people bow down and they say, okay, cool. I need that check or I want that check. So I'll tell the black people to go, you know, do this because they listen to me, you know, because I might be a celebrity. I might be an entertainer. I might be a rapper. I might be an R&B singer. I might be an NBA player, NFL player. Or I might be, you know, I might own several businesses or something. And I'm on Instagram and I got 20 million followers and people will listen to me just because. Right.
Right.
So, you know, this type of thing happens all the time. But again, Ida B. Wells says, I'm not doing it. Right. She took a stand. She was sturdy. She was sturdy. She took a stand and said, no, I'm for my people. She was a race woman. That's why she's been described by so many as a race woman. Mm-hmm. You know, just like Garvey was a race man.
Right.
This woman, Ida B. Wells, was a race woman. Right. She was black first. Right. You know, they start talking about the superintendent and the treasurer start talking about how the streetcars had been converted into electric cars. Right. And then there was a myth that Let me see. That black people stopped riding the streetcars because they were afraid of electricity. Right? So there was this myth going along that, oh, they stopped riding the streetcars because, you know, but they had just made the change about 6 weeks ago. So, you know, but no, actually, no. The electricity had been the power change 6 months before.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, you see, it's a matter of, the superintendent says, you see, it's a matter of dollars and cents with us. If we don't look after the loss and remedy the cause, the company will get somebody else who will. And then Ida B. Wells responds by saying, so your own job then depends on Negro patronage, I asked. And although their faces flushed over the question, they made no direct reply. They respond, you see, it is like this, said the superintendent. When the company installed electricity at a cost of thousands of dollars last fall, Negro labor got a large share of it in wages, in relaying tracks, grading the streets, etc. And so we think it is only fair that they should give us their patronage in return. Now, again, this goes to speak to the mentality of Europeans, right? So, again, they're talking about fair. They're throwing the words around like fair. They're not talking about numbers, though. So you mean to tell me that the amount of income that was generated by those black laborers is going to be equal to the amount of money that you're going to make from black people riding those trains? And again, this is where mathematics comes into play. And this is why it's essential. And I harp on all the time, like teaching our people mathematics so that when white people come and say stuff like that to you and they say, oh, well, that's not fair. And you think, OK, well, where are the numbers at? Because the only way it's fair is if the numbers match up. Mm-hmm. This is all about equations. If the number on the left side of the equal sign is the same as the number on the right side of the equal sign, that's how we know it's fair. Until you start talking about numbers and showing me numbers, and until I understand how to interpret and read those numbers on paper, then we can't have this conversation. Because you could tell me anything. Because it's not fair just because you feel like it's fair. Like Europeans think it's fair that they control the whole continent of Africa right now.
Right.
And the Chinese will think it's fair that it's our turn now. They'll think it's fair. Because we're gonna give you some loans, and you know, United States feels like, oh, it was fair that we had so much influence in the Congo because you know we was paying giving you know Mobutu punk ass all this money all those years.
Mm-hmm. Right?
But until we start talking about actual dollars and cents, don't talk to me about fair. And again, we gotta have a mathematical competency to understand that. So then Ida B. Wells says she responds. Said they were doing so until 6 weeks ago. Basically, they were riding your streetcars until 6 weeks ago. Yet you say you don't know the cause of the falling off. So they come in her office playing dumb and trying to disrespect her and act like she's stupid, right? Why it was just 6 weeks ago that the lynching took place. But the streetcar company had nothing to do with the lynching, said one of the men. It is owned by Northern capitalists. And then she said, and run by Southern lynchers. I retorted, we have learned that every white, and that's another game that, you know, historians try to play today when they talk about the Civil War. Like, oh, it was just the bad white people in the South, good white people up North. No, everybody was eating off of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, all the way up the whole East Coast, everybody was eating off of slavery. All of them was eating off slavery. And run by Southern lynchers, I retorted, we have learned that every white man of any standing in town knew of the plan and consented to the lynching of our boys. Did you know Tom Moss, the letter carrier? Yes, he replied. A finer, cleaner man than he never walked the streets of Memphis, I said. He was well-liked, a favorite with everybody, yet he was murdered with no more consideration than if he had been a dog, because he as a man defended his property from attack. The colored people feel that every white man in Memphis who consented to his death is as guilty as those who fired the guns which took his life, and they want to get away from this town. And he said, and then she said, we told them the week after the lynching to save their nickels and dimes so that they could do so. We had no way of knowing that they were doing so before this, as I have walked more than I ever did in my life before. No one has been arrested or punished about that terrible affair, nor will they, because all are equally guilty. And she says, and then they ask her the question, why don't colored people find the guilty ones? Asked one of them, as if they could. There was strong belief among us that the criminal court judge himself was one of the lynchers. Suppose we had the evidence. Could we get it before that judge?
Man.
Or that judge going to indict himself?
Listen, Brother Akil, we're going to do it.
Or a grand jury of white men who have permitted it to be?
Brother,
or force the reporter of the appeal to tell what he saw and knows about that night? You know very well that we are powerless to do any of these things. But then she's like, okay, this is how we're going to exercise our power. So, you know,
Brother Akil, this is what we're going to do, because this is so good. We're going to stay with
Ida B. Wells, and then we're going to come back next week at your time. If you can do it Monday or Wednesday, I got a guest next Friday, Brother Jeremiah Kamara will be my guest. Okay. I'll talk about his, I don't know if you've seen his documentary, Holy Hierarchy. It's outstanding. That documentary is outstanding, man. In fact, we'll talk after the program, but so we'll continue with the discussion on Ida B. Wells, and we'll come back another date with the discussion on Sister Asada Shakur, okay?
That's perfect.
Let's
that's
go. Perfect. Okay, let's continue.
Yeah. So with that, is you know, she's talking about expatriation, and she's talking about, you know, us, you know, taking a stand. And again, so this to me is like, this is one of the elements of, it's like kind of like a localized Pan-Africanism. Because, you know, a lot of us, I know you talk about this all the time, Baba Oshi, like, you know, we won't be able to realize our full humanity here in the United States.
Right.
We're going to have to expatriate. We're going to have to go somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
you know. And this is what, this is what on a smaller scale, Ida B. Wells and, you know, is organizing the people as a writer, as a, you know, and again, I want to emphasize heavily so that we in 2020 can start to reevaluate our heroes and reevaluate those that we have so much respect for that are getting a bag or getting money. And at the same time, we know good and well that if, you know, some local corporation or some national or transnational corporation came to them and said, listen, we need you to tell black people in this situation, if they were in this situation, we need you to tell black people to stay in Memphis. It's not that bad. We'll make some reforms. We'll make some changes here. And I'm, you know what? I'm going to give you a check for $50,000, right? That's for you. And then we're going to start this program over here, you know, to kind of, you know, help the, you know, the inner city, or we're going to hire some more black people for the railroad company. You know, we'll do that. And it's a lot of people
mm-hmm.
that are self and are respected would take that money.
That's right.
And they would go to their newspaper, use their platform to tell us to know, not leave.
Right.
To stay in Memphis is not that bad, you know. You know, hopefully, you know, they won't, you know, all we got to do is stay in our place. You know, we just can't open up no more grocery stores, right? Don't open up no more grocery stores. Don't compete with the white people. Let the white people do whatever they're doing. Let them make their money. We'll go spend our money with them, but we're going to have jobs, though. So be thankful. I want to think about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this is the historical context. Let me see. And then further, it's written in the book. Let me see. The railroad company superintendent then says, "Well, we hope you will do what you can for us, and if you know of any discourtesy on the part of our employees, let us know, and we will be glad to remedy it." Right. So, and then she says, "When they left the office, I wrote this interview for the next issue of the Free Speech, and then the article told the people to keep up the good work." Not only that, I went to the two largest churches in the city the next Sunday before the paper came out and told them all about it. I urged them to keep on staying off the cars. Right? I think so. That conversation just emboldened her. Like, how dare you come in here with this goofy mess?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Really? Like, the game they try to play is like, oh, well, you know, we didn't lynch them. You know, it's not our fault. Like, we didn't do it. Right? But you lend yourself. You help create and maintain the environment that made their
That's right. That's right.
Easy. So easy to take place. You can't act like you're not a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you never took a stand and said, no, don't do it. You can't do that. And this is like, you know, what, you know, MLK, Dr. King, his quote about the white moderate. The white moderate is worse than the vitriolic, you know, Klansman. Because it's like that, you know, it's similar to what Malcolm said about, you know, I appreciate when I know where a man stands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the white moderate was smiling our face all the time. But the Klansman, I know he wants to kill me. I know that. Okay, I can make plans and I can navigate that better. But like, you know, like, so, I mean, unless you're just of the mindset that you just don't trust any of them until they give you a reason to, you know, then that's a little different. But, you know, the white moderate is like, well, you know, I'm not a Klansman, but, you know, I know who the Klansmen are and I'm not doing anything to stop them from doing what they're doing. You know, so you're just as guilty. You can't claim neutrality,
right?
You know, and what, you know, this is what they're trying to do. And as a business that's generating money and income, you're trying to maintain the status quo, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every time word, and she goes further to say, every time word came of people leaving Memphis, we who were left behind rejoiced. Oklahoma was about to be opened up, and scores sold or gave away property, shook Memphis dust off their feet, and went out west as Tom Moss had said for us to do. They were taking railroads. Some people had to ride in wagons if they couldn't afford the railroad fare, right? This part made me think about, you know, our comedians, you know, culture, cultural creativity, cultural expression, you know, and the quality of certain comedians versus other comedians. And this may be a larger conversation that we should participate in at some point. This passage right here. The last person to go aboard the ferry boat, there was a ferry boat to be taken to go across the Mississippi River to get to the other side of the Mississippi River, right, in terms of going west. The last person to go aboard the ferry boat was a horny-handed son of toil who led a yellow hound. As he started up the gangplank, the dog pulled back. His master, seeing that he had the center of the stage for a moment, yelled, "Come on here. What you want to stay back there for? Want the white folks to lynch you too?" Needless to say, the white men who witnessed this incident did not join in the laughter which followed. Yeah. You know, so there, you know, this is just, you know, and so to me, it just shows that, you know, we took action. You know, we respond. I think it was an appropriate response to our humanity being denied and us not being able to live as humans. And we say, okay, well, you know, we'll leave, you know, and leaving is always an option. You know, if you have, and I think what it makes it easier too is like you have people like Ida B. Wells that, you know, was a propagandist and she had a newspaper and then she was a center of influence and she's like really organizing the people. She's organizing people. Yes, this is what we should do. This is what Tom Moss said. This makes sense. And he was a close friend of mine. And if it was him and it was the three of them, it could be any of us, you know, because we know what happened. Like, you know, all those white people, you know, were ordered to come into the city and shoot at us, even if anything even remotely suspicious. So how can we be comfortable living in a place like this, raising children in a place like this, when any given moment that could happen? Mm-hmm. Right. So this, and that's almost the end of that particular chapter. Let me see.
Well, now she's in Chicago, and now she's going to be starting to bring attention to the lynchings that have been happening for decades.
Right, like I mentioned earlier, she went out to Philly to this writers' conference, linked up with T. Thomas Fortune, and then the news came that the free speech offices had been destroyed because she was influencing and organizing local black people in Memphis to leave out of Memphis, mm-hmm. you know, to do the best for them, for themselves. So they destroyed the office. So it wasn't safe for her to go back there because they were there. Like you mentioned earlier, they definitely were going to attempt to kill her.
Right.
And she understood that. So, did you want to take some calls?
Yeah, let's take a call. I got a caller here. Sure. Caller 602, good afternoon.
Yeah, Brother Oshie, good afternoon, and good afternoon to Brother Parker. You know, I wanted to ask a question because, you know, I live in Memphis, and the county commissioners, they just passed some resolution that they say they label Memphis as racism is a pandemic in Memphis. What does that open up Memphis to? I mean, you know, do they get money or, you know, because, you know, they just passed that resolution recently. The county commissioners, they say there's a pandemic in Memphis. So do they get federal funding for that? Or, you know, if you can explain to me what that opens up.
You mean in terms of the coronavirus?
Ravishing no, not the coronavirus. Just saying racism is a pandemic.
Oh, racism is a pandemic. Oh, okay. Well, that it is. But I don't know about that leading to federal funding. You know?
Yes, that's what I wanted to find out, if they get federal funding, blah, blah, blah.
No. That falls under the heading of, once again, symbolism without substance, labeling Memphis. So you can label any city, particularly in the South, and even in the North, with, that racism, excuse me, is a mental illness. Mm-hmm. That racism is a mental illness. I mean, you can state those things. There's nothing. I mean, it's more symbolism than substance. Let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we have Negroes down here on the radio that say, "Oh, that's bad for Memphis. They shouldn't say that because that's gonna hurt Memphis." And I say, "These Negroes are crazy." Anyway,
yeah.
I just wanted to just get some clarification. Thank you, brother.
All right, brother Marcus. Have a blessed weekend, man. 404. Good afternoon, Queen.
Yeah, brother. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny that, you know, you would be talking about one of my sheroes. I was going through some paperwork and I saw her name and her picture just about an hour ago. Mm. So, Respect to Sister Ida, who wasn't afraid, knew what time it was, and did what she had to do. So, you know, we got proper role models ahead of us. You know, we got things that are people who we can emulate.
Right.
And hope that we can do as good a job and move this thing forward so the struggle continues. Peace to everyone.
All right. Peace. Thanks a lot, Queen. Yeah, she is definitely a model of a woman who had the courage. I mean, and it does take courage in the face of all that was going on. And she addressed a lot of the issues of the times, especially when she went to Chicago because, you know, she could work for the – did she work for the Defender? Yeah, I think she did, didn't she? Worked for the Chicago Defender?
I can't confirm that. I need to look Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay, but I know there was a lot of, you know, at the time that she came in there, you're talking about the early 1910s and maybe before 1920,
right?
Particularly when the red hot summer of 1919, all the riots that happened before that and the ones that happened a little bit after that, Tulsa, Elaine, Arkansas, East St. Louis. I mean, there's a lot. Atlanta, you know, of us, you know, fighting. Because of the ignorance and the hatred and the greediness and selfishness of Europeans, of Caucasians in this country.
And I think, too, like, if we start thinking about, because I'm sure that, like, you know, the European community understands, like, they look at us as somewhat of a nation, even if they don't admit it, because as a result of a lot of those riots, those race riots instigated by, you know, the white community or the European American community, whatever you want to call it, is a huge transference of wealth and a transference of resources. And it's really no different than, you know, if the United States military goes into Iraq, you know, and bombs Iraq and then, you know, takes it over. And now they can, you know, build McDonald's restaurants. And,
right.
You know,
to the victor goes the spoils, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. So this really is war. I mean, yeah. It's there's many ways that, you know, and I think that, again, in terms of teaching our youth and our young people to get them to understand that, you know, this is bigger than just racism or some like a few bad white people or a few bad apples. No, this is war on a large scale, you know, and it always has been. There's nothing different about it. You know what I mean? There was some different, like, I guess, not ideological debates, but I know like Cabral and, you know, some of the members of the Black Panther Party. I think Cabral and specifically Cleaver, because Eldridge Cleaver would say that, you know, the black community is a colony in America. But then, you know, Cabral wanted to be more precise and said, well, you know, the black community in the United States possesses some many aspects of a colony, but there are still some differences at the same time. However, whether you're, you know, and talking about Amilcar Cabral and, you know, the brothers and sisters out there and, you know, that were in Guinea-Bissau, in the Cape Verde Islands, you know, with PAIGC, they were colonized by the Portuguese. Like, mm-hmm. Bottom line, colonized right. by the Portuguese. And we still, you know, were at this around the, in the same time in the 1960s and the 1970s. We were colonized in 2020. We're still colonized, you know, here in the United States.
That's right. I say.
So we have to, you know, think issues like this and experiences like this that were well documented by people like Ida B. Wells. Need to be examined through that type of lens. You know, looking at ourselves as the colonized people. I mean, you know, we had a police like posted up on the corners in your community. It's not to protect us. You know, mm-hmm. It's not to protect us. It's to protect property. You know, and to protect the investments of those that, you know, really, you know, control property and control land. You know, in these spaces. You know, so it is an occupying force. You know, something else that, you know, Eldridge Cleaver, you know, wrote about, you know, again, you know, with, you know, with, we all have our contradictions. He had many contradictions too, but, him kind of describing local police forces as a localized military. Mm-hmm. And they're really different than, you know, Marines or, you know, the army that are, you know, walking around, you know, different places in Afghanistan, Kabul, Afghanistan, or whatever, you know, holding the AK-47, keeping the people in check. And, you know, keeping things in line for American and, you know, NATO or Western investments.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing as, you know, local, whether, you know, you're in Atlanta or you're in Philly or in D.C., Baltimore, Chicago, Memphis, today, wherever. One of the things that I did want to reflect on, I want to go back to, like, in the beginning of Chapter 7, when they talked about, because there's definitely some contemporary things that take place, and we're talking about the youth, and we're talking about like youth, the examples that the youth are given by the mainstream. When we think about like commercial rappers, we think about the entertainers. When she writes that business was practically at a standstill, for the Negro was famous then as now for spending his money for fine clothes, furniture, jewelry, and pianos and other musical instruments. To say nothing of good things to eat. So, you know, you have the, you know, the local rappers, you know, that a lot of us grew up listening to, like, and some of us still listen to, like, Yo Gotti, Young Dolph, a lot, 3-6 Mafia, you know, a lot of these guys that really promote that idea of, okay, success means that we're making white people wealthy, you know?
Mm-hmm, right.
I mean, you might look, they might not conceptualize it like that. They may say, well, success is me, I earn income and I'm able to go purchase things to represent my success. But there are other ways to look at that. You know, it's like, you know, because really what it boils down to is like your success is measured by how wealthy you can make Europeans, not just Europeans, but, you know, Arabs and Asians as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's not just Europeans.
Right.
So,
well, especially today, because in our community, I mean, when you have big ticket items, that's when you are making Caucasians wealthy. But when you're in your mm-hmm. neighborhood, that's when you're making Arabs, Koreans, you know, others wealthy, because those are who are predominant in our neighborhood. In fact, Philadelphia, when I was at the NAACP convention in 1980 in Denver, and in a plenary session of the NAACP, I used to be vice president back in Milwaukee. And the plenary sessions when everybody is there. And I will never forget on the convention floor, a brother from Philadelphia talking about the invasion in his community, literally to tears of people. You know, he said that we got some of these stores from the European Jews and other Germans and so forth. We had these stores, now we're selling out, and a whole bunch of folks in our community who are supposed to be Arabs, who are supposed to be Muslims, who are selling our people, you know, all this stuff, you know, there's taking over, you know. And as I've listened, when I got back to Milwaukee, I seen the same thing. And now across this country, the same thing. Every major city, the same thing. Right now in Milwaukee, there's only one sister that has a service station. There's only one American African service station in the city of Milwaukee. Sister Diana, she's been holding out strong. In fact, she should be so well patronized that she should have a number of other service stations. But the mentality and so forth of our people is just so damn weak. In fact, there were some folks, because they were given credit by this one store was going to defend them because he gives them credit, you know. So that's, you know, when he said that, and I reflect on that, that is predominant throughout this country. When I was in Baltimore, there's a strip mall in Baltimore, and right there in the city. Of course, you know, Baltimore is predominantly us, at least about 60-some percent. In that strip mall, man, everything was run by pretty much Koreans. They had a soul food restaurant where they sell food by the pound. Have you seen that? Heard about that?
So I think I have.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in Baltimore.
Okay.
I remember. What's the name?
Yeah, this
of that?
Is this is near Garrison and what's the Liberty Heights in that neighborhood, in that area. You know. So anyway, you know, you dish your food out, and then at the end they weigh it, and this is your cost. So obviously, if you got some money, you're really hungry, you're gonna pound it on. If you're not, but anyway, even the liquor store, of course, the supermarket, the laundromat, everything in our community not owned by us,
right?
And that's the issue.
And I think also, like, what this brings to light, and again, the history is always key, but what this brings to light is, you know, some other things that we need to do to protect things that we create. Because a lot of people in our community will make the argument that, you know, well, nobody's stopping us from doing this and nobody's stopping us from doing that. And while it may be true that we as a collective, many of us could become more aggressive and more assertive with creating Black businesses, there still is resistance. I mean, because this is, you know, business is war. Economics is warfare, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if we're talking about competition and real competition, and this is also like a conversation I've been having with some people that I want to discuss more on a panel in the future about this issue of vertical integration. So, because what I think is that we're going to really find out who's really a Black business and what melanated people that own businesses are really about the well-being of the Black community and being Black businesses when we really start talking about vertical integration. Because with vertical integration, we're now talking about the Black retailers are getting their supply from Black wholesalers. They're getting their supply from Black manufacturers.
That's great.
They're getting the raw materials from Black people that produce the raw materials.
That's
because
great.
Now what you'll find out is, okay, all these Black businesses that we support, right? Many of them have these relationships with Asian, Arab, and European mm-hmm. wholesalers.
Right.
So now what those wholesalers are going to do is start to apply pressure to the black businesses on the retail end to say, listen, we got something going on. You can't mess that up. And if you try to mess that up, there's going to be consequences and repercussions to that. Now then we'll be able to see, okay, how many of these Black businesses are really about really promoting Black economics on a large scale, on a global scale. That'll be a test. That'll be a major test. Because I can see a lot of these, you know, black businesses that a lot of us love and a lot of us patronize, you know, saying, well, nah, because we have an opportunity to say, okay, like you might, you know, be in an apparel company or whatever. And, you know, somebody might say, okay, well, we're going to start a conglomerate. We're going to start a company. So you don't have to get your blank t-shirts or your blank hoodies. Or your blank tank tops or whatever, you don't have to get them from Hanes. You don't got to get them from Fruit of the Loom. You don't got to get them from Gildan. You don't got to get them from any of these other companies.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get them from some place, a Black-owned distributor. And then when those companies come and say, okay, they start applying pressure, like the question is going to be, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
In light of that. So we'll have to sit and see. So the question would be, are there limits to how Black you want to be in terms of your business,
right?
Or how Black you want to be in terms of how you exercise your economics.
And
that's an uncomfortable conversation that we're going to have to have.
To have it. 404, go ahead, Queen.
Yes, Baba. It still amazes me how we are still in the same condition we were 150 years ago. It still amazes me. But we are really just now catching up to the economic capitalism game that they have played on us. And it'll take us some time to be able to connect with African society. major overnight, maybe in the next 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to start planning now that we have become economic capitalism.
Hey, Queen, I'm sorry, Queen, you're breaking up on me. We didn't understand you.
Oh, okay. I said it'll take some time for us to build and connect with our African people. It may take 15 years, but we must start planning and building now. Got it.
Okay. All right. All right. We only got a couple of more minutes. Thank you, Queen. We only got a couple more minutes, Brother Akil. Go ahead and wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the sister. I mean, definitely, it's going to take some time, and we just have to have a committed core group of our people that are willing to, you know, do that work and, you know, take that time, you know, work at it on a daily basis. And, you know, and again, like some, you know, something that often comes up in these conversations is like, you know, some people get burnt out. Some people feel like, you know, this isn't going to work or it hasn't worked. Well, you know, like I learned from studying the late Dr. Bobby Wright, you know, also, you know, did a lot of work in Chicago.
I got
to be Wellesley.
Yeah.
We might not be, he said, we might not be supposed to see it in our lifetime. But the work has to be done, because if the work is not done, then our grandchildren and our great grandchildren definitely won't see it.
Right.
So it may just be an act of selflessness to put forth effort for future generations. And I think that has to become part of our mentality that, you know, because a lot of people say, well, you know, we've been struggling, we've been doing this, we've been organizing, we've been going to these meetings and, you know, nothing, you know, it's been 5 years and nothing's changed, or it's been, you know, 2 years and nothing's changed. Well, you know, the key is to hit critical mass, but you never know when it's going to hit critical mass. We just never know. Or at least I don't know, even as a mathematician, like, I don't know the formula, you know, or the equation or the algorithm to figure out, okay, well, when will it hit critical mass? When will we reach critical mass? I don't know it, but I just know that the work has to be done.
Right.
So,
and that's the thing.
People work areas. We just got to keep, you know, doing our work and definitely educating our youth.
That's right.
Telling them about people like Ida B. Wells in ways that are relevant, you know, to their lived experience in 2020 and, you know, in 2021 when that comes. And, you know, people like, you know, Asada Shakur, formerly Joanne Chesimard, that, you know, that we're going to talk about next week, you know?
Well, listen, my brother, I appreciate it. You know I do. We'll be talking with you real soon. I'm going to get ready to. In fact, I'm getting out the house today, man.
Gotta get
been in the house too long.
Got to get that vitamin D from the sunlight.
That's right. It's critical. It's cute. I mean, I take vitamin D every day, but it's not like the sunlight. That's a different story, you know. That's vitally important for that to build up your resistance and to build up your immune system. Vitally important in these days and times. So we thank you once again, my brother, Brother Akil Parker. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do it out, and they sure in the hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a great weekend. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bivivahore means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. You have a blessed and wonderful weekend. I see you on Monday. And remember, my guest next Friday will be Brother Jeremiah Kamara, but I'll announce that. Peace, family.